everybody. Welcome to the Large Neutron Collider podcast, the podcast that's all about the geeky things happening in the world around us and how excited we are about them. I'm Ariel Kasten. I've got a burp. And with me, as always, is the gonna cover it, Jonathan Strickland.
You don't know how it feels to be me.
I don't know how it feels to be you. Only what you've told me.
Yeah, we were talking before recording about karaoke, and I was joking about singing that particular song, which is a Tom Petty song. Doesn't matter. We're gonna talk about geeky things now, and none of them, as far as I know, relate to Tom Petty, but they do relate to us, and that includes stuff what we have done since the last recording that falls into geek territory. And Ariel says here you watched our sun get devoured in the sky.
Yes, but only very poorly. I didn't actually have glasses, and technically the fullness of the eclipse in Atlanta, Georgia hit at a time when I had already started work, but I did watch it. That's probably the geekiest thing I watched all week.
Yeah. I went outside at around 2:40, 2:45, which was about 15 minutes before we got to a little bit more than 15 minutes before we got to the fullness that we would get, which was around 80%. So we kind of got like crescent moon kind of status with the sun, and sat outside on a little lawn chair and watched it. I did have some eclipse glasses, so I was able to watch the whole thing. Liked it. It was great. It was obviously not nearly as impressive as the totality we got in 2017, but it was still cool to watch. And my partner was up in Erie, Pennsylvania, seeing it in totality. That was pretty much the only geeky thing you watched, was the eclipse.
We're doing, so I've talked about my friend's watch party that we do. We've been doing weekly since the pandemic, and it looks like it might be coming to an end because, I don't know if I talked about this last week, stop me if I did. Amazon at first rolled out there, you have to pay a little bit more if you don't want ads in our streaming service, which, yeah, whatever. I mean, wasn't super happy about it, but I also am like, I'll just deal with the ads. And then they made it so that you could only start or host a watch party if you bought the without ads service. Now, it's not very expensive to upgrade, so we had a couple of friends who did. Now, neither of those friends can start a watch party. It looks like without, this has kind of been in the news, so you probably already know about it, without really any warning. They've gotten rid of that capability. We knew they were getting rid of it on Twitch, but they haven't really been like, oh, we're getting rid of Watch Party altogether. And so my friends who bought the no ad service to help us watch the Watch Party are a little frustrated. And we tried to go to Teleparty, but Teleparty is not suited to deal with everybody getting ads at different times and some people not having ads. And everybody's trying to figure out what's wrong when really it's just paused because one person's watching an ad and then everybody else is trying to start it again, and it just gets very frustrating. So,
got it.
We're finishing up Vox Machina. We'll probably tomorrow do something where we all put it on Amazon and on Discord go 3, 2, 1, start, and then just talk about it at the end.
It's like watching Riff Tracks.
Yeah.
The old Riff Tracks where you would just get the audio file and it would cue you when to start the movie with audio file. And
Yeah, pretty much. But I don't know if we're going to continue trying to do that afterwards. I'm fine with it. At least one of my very good friends who attends it does that on the regular because Teleparty doesn't work for them. But we'll see. And I guess during lunch today, I was watching the latest episode of Fantasy High Junior Year.
Now for me, I watched all of Fallout last night, all approximately, well, it's definitely more than 7 hours. I don't know if it's all the way up to 8, but I watched the whole thing.
Wowza.
Yeah, 8 episodes. Wow. Some of the episodes are not an hour long. Some of them are closer to like 35, 40 minutes, but most of them are right around an hour or so. And I watched the whole thing start to finish. And I have lots of thoughts on it. Mostly positive. I liked the show. I thought the set design and the costume design was out of this world. I thought those designs were phenomenal. I was surprised at the amount of gore, although I shouldn't have been, considering that Fallout even has a perk you can get that makes everything gorier, like people explode when you shoot them and stuff. But there was quite a bit of gore that I was kind of surprised by. And while there was humor, I didn't feel like there was as much humor in the series as there happens to be in the games. And that it takes a while for the humor to really start coming through. Like, there's some very dry humor in the first two episodes, but the weird stuff doesn't start coming in until later.
That's unfortunate, because the trailer sure made it look like it was going to be, I mean, dark, but also a comedy kind of, to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was entertaining. They did use a lot of the music from the games. So a lot of the songs, like that you would hear on the radio station in the games, a lot of those were songs that were used. They used most of those up by the first like five episodes though. So by the last three episodes, I'm like, oh, well, this is a song that's from that era and it's in that kind of style, but it's not one that I recognize from one of the games. But they use like by that time around episode five or six, I started noticing the actual score from the game making its way into the show. And I didn't notice it in the early episodes. So that was interesting. And the only thing that I'm not going to give any spoilers. I think I can't even really talk about the plot, because the plot, like early on, there's a spoiler that is kind of the important element of for the whole plot. So I'm not going to talk about that. I'll say that it was very Fallout-ish. There were a couple of specific references to things that have appeared in Fallout games beyond like general ideas, right? Like beyond certain factions or certain kinds of monsters or whatever. One character from an actual Fallout game has a cameo in the series, which I thought was cool. And then a really important location in one of the Fallout games is hinted at the very end of the final episode, and that was cool. So I really liked the fact that it was a show that catered to fans of the series. Like, if you were a fan of the series, you're like, oh, well, this isn't retelling one of the games. It's a new story, but it very much feels like it's set in that world.
Do you need to be familiar with those references to enjoy the show? Because as I have said before, I've played Fallout. I spent hours making my character and then could not get out of the bunker because cockroaches kept killing me. That's comedy, you guys. But that's the amount of Fallout references that I understand.
Well, clearly, you need to work on your VATS training, because VATS will get you out of pretty much any fight, because you don't have to do it manually. If you use VATS, it's way easier. But
don't remember what VATS is.
That's it. It's kind of like bullet time in a way. It lets you specifically target a monster in particular parts, and it freezes everything. It pauses everything, so you're not shooting in real time. It's very useful.
I tried to do that. If I recall correctly, I use that in. That's how I get through all of the Mass Effect games that allow me to do it. I don't remember if all of them allowed me to do it, but I played all the Mass Effect games, and it's largely by freezing, aiming, and going. And sometimes it's by like pausing the game because I can't freeze it, just to see where it is, and then unpausing and aiming, and then pausing again, making sure it's right, unpausing, shooting, because I'm really bad at that. I've gotten better. I'm still not great at it. But the thing is, the cockroaches were so fast and I couldn't find my way out, and they kept respawning. And like, I'd shoot one in VAT time, the other one would just scurry up and kill me. I hated it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry you had such a frustrating experience, but no, to answer your original question, you do not have to have played the games to really understand, because they introduce tons of concepts and organizations and stuff that are intrinsic to the games, but they do so in a way where you understand what they are just in the series. You don't need to have played the games. So like Vault-Tec is a great example. Vault-Tec is the company that made the vaults, obviously. That company plays a huge part in the story of this series, but they do a really good job of introducing what Vault-Tec is. In fact, more so than I would argue some of the games do. So they also answer some really big questions that have been open questions in the Fallout game community. So if you take the series as canon, they actually solve one of the longest standing mysteries of the Fallout universe. Again, no spoilers. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but I really appreciated that. So while I had some issues with the tone and I had some issues with the appearance of and nature of humor, sometimes it felt like it just really was out of place, but then that can happen in the games too. Overall, I thought the series was an incredible achievement.
Nice, nice. Oh, I did forget one geeky thing I did. I've been playing Beat Saber. I don't know if I was doing that last week.
You were, yeah. You had started playing it last week, I remember. So are you enjoying Beat Saber?
I'm doing it more. I am. I've kind of gotten off of the campaign mode, and I'm just playing solo play now, and I like some of the songs. There's a Lindsey Stirling song that's just really a lot of fun to play, and it's very zenny. And if you put the Dragon Force song on, like, normal, it's, and then you also put yourself on no-fail mode, it's pretty good. Which is actually what one of, like, the commentators on how to play Beat Saber better said, was, like, put a song on a difficulty, put it on no fail and go through it, because you won't, that way you'll learn the song and you'll get better at it. If you don't get through the song the first time, you're not going to know what's happening. Right. So I don't know. I'm enjoying it. Yeah. I need to buy, we got it on Steam specifically so we could get some like fan made songs like DuckTales and stuff. So we got to set that up, but.
Right. Yeah. Fun. I've seen videos on YouTube of people playing Beat Saber, and they're playing songs where I'm like, oh, wow, did they license that song? That's incredible. And then I looked into it, oh, no, that was a mod that they did where they were able to take other songs and then create Beat Saber, like courses or whatever with that music. Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. I realized that the modders are walking a fine line, because that's a licensing nightmare if you're the company behind Beat Saber, but...
Yeah, I also plan on buying, they do have a lot of fun songs in packs that you can buy through Beat Saber, just like with Guitar Hero or Rock Band or whatnot. So I do plan on getting those as well. But there's just like one or two songs I was like, if Beat Saber had this song, I would buy it from Beat Saber.
Totally, totally. No, I and there's no judgment here, because goodness knows, like, I've had so many cases where there's some form of media that I would love to have access to, but there was like no legal way to do it in the United States. And I would sit there and say, do I do an illegal access? And then just my goal is to pay for it as soon as it's legally available. Or do I just go without? And I'm not ashamed to say that occasionally I've engaged in a little shady skullduggery in order to watch or access something that I really wanted.
I generally, you know, we've talked about, I generally say pay for your media, right? but if it's something that you need to pay for, obviously, like, you're listening to us, and you can just do that because out of the goodness of our hearts right now. But out of the goodness of our hearts always. But, you know, I have, like, when I was paying for BBC specifically as a channel, I'd watch Doctor Who. And then my friend had, like, the extended version that you could get in the UK but not here. So occasionally I would watch that. I think that's not as much of a thing anymore.
No, for me, it was things like, so the thing that I always think about, well, there's two. Battle Royale, which was, you know, a Japanese thriller kind of horror movie about a bunch of kids forced to fight each other to the death. It's really grim. For a long time was not available in the United States at all. Like, it was just, you couldn't get it. And so I got a bootleg copy of that so I could watch it. And then as soon as it became available in the United States, I went ahead and bought the DVD. And another example is the Mitchell and Webb look, because it was available on Netflix for a while, but then the licensing expired and it went away, and I could not get an American version of it. Like, it just didn't exist. And so I ended up watching episodes on YouTube for a while until I was finally able to buy British versions of the DVD. And then I bought a region-free DVD player so that I could, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't work because the regions are different. So, like, I get really frustrated when media companies don't make it easy to access stuff legally, because that's what really encourages piracy. I'm not saying piracy's right. I'm saying that it's totally understandable if you really want access to something and companies, for whatever reason, just do not make it available. And if you're willing to pay for it and you still can't, then a lot of people will take that extra step to pirate it. And while it's not right, I do understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of monopolies, let's get to our 30 seconds and less.
Yeah, because we got a whole bunch of them and we've got some news stories to go through. And then it is the return of a long lost friend to the show, that being mashups. Yes, folks, we will have mashups at the end of this episode. So that's something for you to either look forward to or dread. But in order to get there, we got to do some 30 seconds or less. And I think, Ariel, you're up first.
Yes, yes. And I kind of alluded to what I was going to talk about. Margot Robbie, with her company Lucky Chap, is producing Monopoly, the board game, the movie. She's working with Hasbro to do it. You know, we've had a will-they-won't-they relationship with a Monopoly movie in a big while. I personally don't think that she can beat the last Monopoly movie I watched, The Big Short. But if it's as good as Barbie, I will give it a watch.
Well, she was in The Big Short, so, you know, maybe she'll bring some of that energy over. Although, if she spends the entire film of Monopoly in a bubble bath with champagne, I mean, they're going to sell a billion tickets. So, all right. For those of y'all out there itching for a Jon Snow spinoff of Game of Thrones, I've got some bad news. Kit Harington, who played Snow in the TV series, says the project is now, quote, off the table, end quote, and essentially dead in the water. As for the reason, Harington says that the development team could never find the right story to tell, which is weird, because I thought it was obvious. I mean, Snow goes to kindergarten so he can finally know something.
That's funny. He is in Henry V with National Theater, if you've got that subscription and you want to watch him know something. This one is really short. I'm not really going to say a lot on it. Jonathan Majors did finally get sentenced for the accusations of domestic abuse that had been filed against him. He doesn't have jail time, but he does have a year-long in-person domestic violence counseling program that he needs to complete. And then Grace Jabari, his ex-girlfriend, does have a protection order for her sanity. So it looks like this chapter of everything is coming to a close.
Yep. Then it'll truly come to a close when we find out whatever the heck Marvel is doing in the wake of all that. Okay. Many years ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger starred in a very, very loose adaptation of Stephen King's The Running Man, and it barely resembled the source material. And currently, Edgar Wright, the genius behind films like Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver, is going to direct a new adaptation, and Glenn Powell, whom I know as Traitor Number One in The Dark Knight Rises, is starring in it. Wright co-wrote the script, so I'm hoping that there's going to be a Cornetto cameo in the new film.
Interesting. I do like Edgar Wright. Okay. Prince of Persia is getting a new game. This time it's being developed by the Dead Cells studio Evil Empire. I said that poorly. Dead Cells, if you couldn't understand me the first time. It's got a really cool kind of, not quite, but almost Samurai Jack feel to it. It's 2D. The trailer at least makes it look like a 2D platformer. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I love that series, and I love every different iteration they've done, so that's cool. All right, well, I remember watching The Blair Witch Project back in 1999 and being thoroughly creeped out. Not from the movie, but there was this guy sitting two seats down from me who took his shoes off in the movie theater. Anyway, there have been a few attempts to turn the film into a franchise or to reboot the whole thing. And now we're doing it again. Lionsgate and Blumhouse will produce the film. No word yet if it will be a found footage film or a more standard movie. I'm so scared.
I never watched that. And also, I did not take my shoes off near you. I wouldn't do that to poor people in a theater. Fumi Games unveiled their trailer for their game Mouse, which features a Steamboat Willie-esque hero. It feels very Cuphead. It's a first-person shooter. The weirdest thing to me is that while the character has many mouse powers, it also has a Popeye power in that it can eat power-up spinach and get stronger. So it's an interesting mix of old IP.
Yeah. Yeah. Why worry about logic when you don't have to pay for anything? So if you missed seeing Dune Dune, aka Dune Part 2, in the theaters, don't worry. We now know when it's coming to your home, if you want it to. Starting April 16th, the day after your taxes are due here in the United States, you can rent or purchase the film digitally. If you prefer physical media, then you just have to wait until May 14th to get it on Blu-ray or DVD. There will be lots of special material for those formats, including tons of behind-the-scenes footage and, who knows, maybe some sand.
I like sand.
Yeah, it makes you different from Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah. Hopefully it will keep me from getting burned in lava. So David Lynch, you know, wants to make a children's cartoon called The Snoots? Snoot World. It's called Snoot World. And Netflix said, no, we don't want it. Lynch thinks it's because the story is kind of more old-fashioned fairy tale-esque, where the jokes aren't right at the top of it. Which, who knows what that means? You could interpret that 1,000 different ways, but I will just read the plot of the film as Lynch describes it, according to Collider.com. It takes my breath away how wacky it is. The snoots are these tiny creatures who have a ritual transition at age 8, at which time they get tinier and they are sent away for a year so they are protected. The world goes into chaos when the snoot hero of the story disappears into the carpet and his family can't find him, and he enters a crazy, magnificent world. Feels vaguely Dr. Seussian.
Yeah, and I rearranged our 30 seconds or less so that Ariel would have to talk about a David Lynch animated film after Dune because, you know, Lynch once directed a version of Dune.
I liked that.
You liked that version? Some people really do, and there's nothing wrong with that. It is very weird. Sting is in it.
Maybe not in its entirety, but I liked it, so yeah.
All right. Well, once upon a time, there was a Nintendo Switch emulator called Yuzu, and Yuzu would let you play Switch games without a Switch, among other things. But Nintendo sued Yuzu off the face of the earth, and now two other emulators called Suyu and Sudachi have been exiled from Discord, and their lead developers have had their Discord accounts disabled. One does not threaten the IP dominance of Nintendo, it would seem.
Wow. And lastly, as I said, I'm watching Legend of Vox Machina. We are currently in season 2. We're 2 episodes away from the end of season 2. I've seen it before, but we're watching it again. We have no actual word of when season 3 is going to come out, just that it's really, really good, according to Liam O'Brien. However, if you are jonesing for your Vox Machina fix, in the meantime, they have come out with a vinyl of the soundtrack from season 2. The discs are really pretty. They're gold with some purple in there. And they have some cool artwork in the bifold, trifold, whatever it is, the thingy that holds the vinyl disc. So if you got a record player and you like Vox Machina and you're in that Venn diagram of geek, enjoy.
All right. And that's our 30 seconds or less. Now we can talk about trailers.
Yeah. Yeah, most of which are not really for me, and a couple of them might be on the verge of not kid-friendly, just as a forewarning.
I mean, we do horror movie trailers all the time, but this time, yeah, there's one in particular that's about an industry that is definitely not kid-friendly.
I shouldn't give that warning. Just sometimes it's less that I never, it's not that I don't always think we need it, it's just sometimes I forget.
Yeah. But we'll start with one that is less salacious, and that is Fly Me to the Moon, which is an upcoming comedy film about NASA and the space race and the moon landing. And it follows a PR expert who's brought in to kind of zhuzh up NASA's public image in order to get the American public to really buy into the moon landing, and it stars ScarJo.
And also Channing Tatum, yeah. I think is correct. I actually really like him. I think he's got amazing comedic timing, and he's also a very sincere actor. So I just, there was a spoof on his name once in a bit on a late night TV show, and now my brain always second guesses it when I say it.
It's kind of like Benedict Cumberbatch. Like, for the longest time, no one would say his name correctly. And until it got to a point where that joke was so overused that only old people like me still do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the trailer for Fly Me to the Moon looks delightful. I liked Hidden Figures, which is certainly a much more poignant story.
Yes.
than Fly Me to the Moon is, where the problem is, hey, the people who are working on the moon landing are not charismatic and we need to hire pretend people to be them.
Yeah, and then even fake the moon landing itself like that as a backup in case the actual moon landing doesn't happen or doesn't go well. They've got the studio made version of the moon landing, which obviously that's been like a conspiracy forever. Mm-hmm. And they even make a Stanley Kubrick joke about it, because Kubrick at one point was rumored to have actually overseen the filming of a fake moon landing. This case, we don't get Stanley Kubrick. We get Jim Rash, which I'm all for, because I loved him on Community. So,
yeah, he's super funny. This looks cute. It looks like it would be just a fun, easy way to spend an afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah. This doesn't look like it's a real thinker, but it might be entertaining and diverting, they might say. Whereas our next trailer, which is for a film called Crazy House, feels like it doesn't quite know what the film is. This is a movie starring Nick Frost, and the way it starts off is it starts off like it's a sitcom. It made me think of Too Many Cooks, honestly, if I'm going to compare it to anything. But it looks like a sitcom, and then it unfolds that the sitcom is not what is actual reality, I guess. And instead, it's like some sort of home invasion thing. And things escalate from there. And I don't really know what to think of it.
Yeah, I like Nick Frost. And I like the idea of, I mean, it's not completely undone. It's been done well and poorly. The idea of being in a pretend world to escape from the reality of what's happening. The worst example I've seen of that is Sucker Punch, but no offense if you like Sucker Punch out there and you're listening. I'm glad for you. It was not for me. I don't know. It didn't grab me. I'm touchy on religious humor in general, and it just didn't feel very clever to me. I did like a joke where Nick Frost mentioned Santa Claus because he has played Santa Claus in Doctor Who. So that was the highlight of the trailer for me.
Well, I'm sorry. It made me think of a series. I don't know how many people actually watch this, and I'm going to have to censor myself because the title of the series has an expletive, but it's Kevin Can Bleep Himself. And in that series, it was a really weird decision they made. Cool. Like they made it on purpose, but it was a weird decision where, from one character's perspective, the show is presented like a multi-camera sitcom. And from a different character's perspective, it's presented as a single camera drama. And so it shifts back and forth between these two different, totally different perspectives and tones and styles to tell these different stories. And that's kind of what the beginning of Crazy House made me think, because it looked like it was playing with that perception deal. But I don't actually know what's going on. Like, I don't know if in the context of the film itself it's supposed to be a show, or if like a character just imagines their life like a show. I don't know.
Yeah I do feel like we won't do it, but I feel like in talking about not knowing what's real and what's not, we should be talking about Joker Folia Dude next, but
we will get there. Yeah. Instead, next, what we're going to talk about. So Ty West is a filmmaker who is from Atlanta, In fact, a lot of the people, a lot of the people I know have worked with Ty West on various projects, but Ty West has a trilogy of films that started with a movie called X, and then the second film was a film called Pearl, and now we're getting the third of those films called Maxine, and it's Maxine with three X's, which should be the indication that this is the very much not kid-friendly portion of the discussion we're having. But she, it's a character who has wanted to be a star, wanted to be famous, and she does through the venue of adult entertainment. And looks like there's like a stalker element to it. So this looks like a slasher slash stalker kind of horror thriller film. And it looks extremely atmospheric, which Ty West is known for. Ty West is like, if there's one thing I can say about his films that is consistently impressive, it's that he's very good at creating a specific feel for each of his movies.
I don't think I've seen a Ty West movie before. I was confusing X with Triple X, and I didn't know Pearl was related at all. And I kind of thought that Maxine was the female reboot of Triple X.
No, none of those.
Until I watched the trailer.
Vin Diesel does not show up in any of these movies. He does not play some sort of crazy James Bond-esque spy in any of these films. For people who want to check out Ty West movies and you want to know a good place to start, I would say, I mean, it depends on how patient you are, because you need to like movies that have very slow pacing, which I do. Like, I like movies that are very mm-hmm. deliberately paced, not slow, but they're deliberate. And House of the Devil and The Innkeepers are both very good, but they're both also very deliberate and slow paced. And so, like, I could see like modern horror audiences who are more used to things like jump scares and stuff not being entertained by these movies, because that's not the kind of films they are. But if you like mm-hmm. really atmospheric stories that slowly crank up tension, I think those are great films to start with. The X and Pearl and Maxine films, at least X and Pearl, I can tell you, that ratchets things up significantly, so maybe start with Innkeepers or House of the Devil.
Gotcha. Is Maxine supposed to be a horror? It kind of looked like True Detective met Pulp Fiction to me.
I honestly don't know. It could be that they make it more of a thriller than like a horror
Sin City
film.
Or something.
Because, but I can tell you this, X and Pearl both, well, X certainly is a horror movie. That's done in the slasher style, but there's a twist to it. Pearl is kind of a film about psychosis, I would argue. Pearl focuses on a character who was in X, but it's essentially a prequel. It happens like 50 mm. years before X does. They're brilliant movies in their own way. But yeah, it's definitely for people who are big into horror, and they're big into storytelling and horror, not like the jump scare style horror. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with jump scare horror, by the way. I love some of those movies, but that's not what these are.
My favorite kind of horror, I guess it's not even horror, it's more like psychological thriller or suspense.
Well, you also like monster movies.
I do, but I wouldn't consider, and maybe I'm just misremembering, but like Bram Stoker's Dracula was neither jump scares nor too gory for me. Frankenstein was not like the really old, like Creature from the Black Lagoon, maybe had a couple jump scares, but again, they weren't super gory. They weren't super jump scary.
Yeah. I just think of those as sort of a subgenre under, like, I think horror is a pretty big genre, and there's lots of little subgenres around under it. And some of them are things like supernatural horror, or, you know, you got your slasher horror, you got your, you know, thriller type horror films. Thriller can also fall under drama or action. But I mean, it just kind of, it's all how you categorize and organize stuff. And I think it kind of comes down to personal preference. I generally do it the way old school video rental services would do it, right? Like you would go and like, oh, I found Little Shop of Horrors and it was in the horror section when really it should be in comedy, but okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Or musicals. Comedy and musical don't always go together.
That's true. In fact, they often do not.
So what would you, what kind of horror would you categorize our next trailer under? In fact, the trailer is called Under Paris.
I'd put it under monster movies. I said that Under Paris is essentially Jaws goes to France, which is pretty accurate. Like the story is that some giant shark has been swimming up the Seine River and is now essentially in France. And of course, this is just when there's going to be this big swimming event along the Seine River. And so it really yelled out Jaws to me, because obviously one of the big plot points in Jaws is the mayor of Amity refuses to shut down the beaches because it's their big summer and they don't want to lose tourist money. I feel like there's almost an identical example here where you've got this big sporting event, and even though the people in charge know that there's a predator in the water, they're like, their hubris tells them they'll be fine and that they can't afford to cancel this event. I'm feeling like that's part of this story. But yeah, there's a, the trailer is okay. Like, you know, it doesn't have the janky charm of Jaws, which I honestly worked in that film's favor. It uses a lot of CGI sharks, but you know, it was one of those things where I was like, I can dig that they are clearly inspired by Jaws. Whether or not anyone ever like admits that, I don't know, but it's obvious to me.
I feel like the biggest inspiration from Jaws is they show a woman screaming and bleeding in the water, which was the very most frightening part of the original Jaws to me, and therefore told me that I probably should not watch Under Paris. I watch some scary shark movies, but I like swimming in the ocean too much. Oh, also, it's all in French, so either understand French or there are subtitles in the trailer.
Yeah. Go understand French, you plebe. Je ne parle pas français bien malheureusement, so it's not for me. Jaws is my favorite film of all time. It's my top film. It's my number one. I think it's almost a perfect movie. And the only reason it's almost perfect is because the shark gimmick did not work most days when they were shooting, and it forced them to be very creative with the way that they presented the horror.
I love the story of Jaws, and I love Jaws in concept, but I do not enjoy watching it. I watched it as an adult in the movie theater on one of those retro nights, and it still scared the bejesus out of me. So
I went to Florida and was staying at a hotel on the beach, and they showed it on a floating screen over the ocean.
That's mean. That's mean. That's nope. Nope. I would nope right out of there. I'd be like, yeah. I'm never leaving my hotel room again.
Well, next up, finally, after so much teasing, we've been teasing this teaser for the entire episode. We're ready to talk about Joker, Folie à Deux.
I thought you said French wasn't for you.
It's not. I did a terrible job saying that. So,
yeah. So I watched this trailer with my husband when it came, the night it came out, and we had very different opinions on it. To me, it kind of, it almost felt more like a Batman Joker DC movie than the previous one ever seemed to be to me.
Hmm. Interesting.
Which is not very helpful for anybody who hasn't watched the trailer.
it's a teaser. It's not a full trailer. But you get the character who is the Joker in this version talking about finding someone so he's no longer alone, and of course he's alluding to Harley Quinn. We get a bit of Lady Gaga's Harley Quinn. I think her aesthetic works in terms of this version of the Joker. I mean it's very different from the Harley Quinns we've seen before, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just different. And
I mean, there is one point where she has a closer to traditional Harley Quinn aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah. But for the most part, she looks quite different, but again, so does Joker. So it's not, I just think of them as interpretations on the character. You don't really get that big of an indication about it being a musical. I mean, there are little indications, there are little hints and stuff, but it doesn't fly out at you. It's kind of like in the more recent trend of musicals downplaying the fact that they're musicals.
Yeah. There's a moment where Lady Gaga is singing in a choir with other people, I guess, at Arkham Asylum. And then there's a moment where Joker and Harley are dancing on stage, much like in the first Joker movie, where you spend much of the movie going in and out of reality between what Joker is making up in his head and what is actually happening. It looks like this movie also plays a lot on what is real versus what is imagined.
Yeah. And again, that's understandable. It's a way to try and convey the madness of the Joker. As we still are in this era of playing up bad guys whose villainous trait is that they are mentally unwell. Like, that was a big part of the first Joker film. But it does create issues like with the stigma around mental health. So that's a conversation for another time, I guess.
But it is interesting because, like, again, when my husband watched The Joker, he didn't ever view Joaquin Phoenix's character until the very end as a villain. He was the victim, right? And it was the victimization that drove him to be a villain. So it is, but it also plays on some real sketch area of making, I can't think of the word all of a sudden, but basically giving excuses to make something okay. I think that writing villains as insane is lazy.
Yes. Agreed. And it's also obviously dangerous, right? Like if you write villains that way, then again, you can continue to push a stereotype or a trope that doesn't actually reflect reality and yet still can shape people's opinions about folks who do have struggles with mental health. So yeah, there's that too. I mean, that's been an issue with like villains for a really long time. I mean, it's a very kind of shortcut way to describe a villain. Plus, you don't ever have to describe a villain's motivations that way, right? You never have to give any real good motivation because they're just quote unquote crazy. But that's kind of the whole point of Joker.
You can also have mental illness or struggles or whatnot or diagnoses, and not be bad because of that, but be pushed to a breaking point because of the way people treat you because of that. So again, this could be a whole conversation, but I do have a theory about this movie, which is that all of the relationship between Joker and Harley Quinn is made up in his mind because he saw her once.
Yeah. I mean, it would follow spoilers. It would follow in the footsteps of the first film in that case. But we'll have to, obviously, with just a teaser, we're going to have to wait a while longer to get more material. I think most folks, if they've seen the first film, they already know whether or not they're going to see this one. Like, to me, this is one of those movies where you don't even really need to market it apart from telling people when it's out.
Yeah, I agree. For me, I much prefer the Joker that his villainousness comes from toxic chemicals. So,
There's the great Alan Moore version where he was a failed comedian who is then pressured into entering into a life of crime as the Red Hood and then is pushed into the vat of chemicals. And that, so it ends up being the combination, right? Because he's failed comedian who gets pulled into crime through no choice of his own. It's not like he chose crime. It's that he had to do it. And then on top of that, he ends up having this terrible mutilation. So then you get the best of both worlds. It's so good.
Yeah, chef's kiss. Okay. Next, we have a trailer for Dark Matter, which is an Apple TV show starring Joel Edgerton and Jennifer Connelly. I don't know why I'm talking about it like it's a 30-second or less thing. I didn't know this was happening. A lot of Apple TV stuff. They make a lot of stuff, and some of it gets under my radar. But this feels – it's about a guy who is dabbling in the multiverse based on – like decisions you make, and each decision you make creates a new multiverse. He dies and wakes up in another universe and then goes down the rabbit hole. It feels also kind of fringe to me, this trailer.
I mean, there's a whole thing where it sounds like he's been kidnapped by himself and that like another alternate version of himself has gone to take his place in his world, which is lifting directly off of a fantasy novel called Moon Dreams by this guy named Brad Strickland, who's my dad. But, you know, I'll overlook it.
It is pulling directly from the book Dark Matter by Blake Crouch.
Yeah.
Science fiction thriller series.
Clearly copied Brad Strickland, who is, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not saying that.
Possibly.
No, there's.
Possibly. I don't know when their various books came out. So.
This is an idea that I think would be very easy to come about when you start thinking about parallel universes, that kind of thing. And it looks like it's also got a little bit of the sort of the lo-fi approach to the science fiction elements, which I'm all for. It makes me think of a Primer. Which was a time travel movie that was very lo-fi with its special effects and stuff, but still told a really compelling story. That's what this kind of looks like to me. Like it looks like this nondescript block of a building that is the gateway to whatever their version of the multiverse is, which is kind of neat. So I am all for more series that are using science fiction to tell compelling stories. Like I'm still waiting for Severance season 2, because Severance also is using a science fiction idea, and the science fiction, I mean, it plays a part. It's important in the series, but it's not the focus of the series. It just enables the story to be told. And I cannot wait for season 2. So like Apple TV in particular has been kind of catching my attention with these sorts of projects.
Yeah, I agree that they're trying to corner a market, whether intentionally or not. They seem to be. Is Severance getting a season 2?
Yes, which is awesome. Good, because they left off with a cliffhanger, The last I heard, like there was, I mean, obviously it got delayed during the strikes. So I don't know. I know I saw not too long ago an update about when they were hoping to at least finish the series, if not launch it. But I can't remember what that was.
Yeah, I mean, everything is still a little like back when the strike ended. I was saying it was being said that like things would ramp up quickly, but that hasn't been the case. Things have kind of slowed back down, at least in Atlanta. Partially because we might be looking at an IATSE strike. So, I was just more curious because I know there are things that were getting developed pre-strike that then got slashed post-strike. So I hope that's not one of them.
Yeah, I think Severance is still on track, but I have not looked into it, so... maybe by next week, gotcha. I will have done my homework and I will be able to answer that. As long as that
homework that you didn't know you had.
Yeah, as long as that homework also doesn't include having to watch the first two seasons of Bridgerton, because I've never watched an episode and you put the trailer for season 3 on here.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it would be for you, Jonathan.
I mean, it's...
And not it's because it's a romance.
It's lots of people dressed in fancy clothes or sometimes undressed in them, being all fancy and stuff and being all romancing on each other.
It does this weird, like... It's a period drama, but it's not period accurate. It's not like Downton Abbey that went more for accuracy, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not super well versed in that time period. So there's a lot of like anachronistic stuff, kind of like A Knight's Tale, mm-hmm. Which maybe it's me. That wasn't my favorite thing, but I do like Bridgerton. It's a light popcorny watch sometimes.
Did you go to the big Bridgerton experience that was here in Atlanta when they were doing that?
I did not. I did not want to have to pay for a Bridgerton dress to go pay to take pictures, to post on Instagram and have a drink and dance at a party by myself.
Yeah, it was right across the street from me. I could have gone with you. Then you wouldn't have to dance with yourself. You could dance with me. You know me. I cut a rug. I shake a leg.
Yeah, but I don't modern cut a rug. If they were doing actual dances, Regency dances, I would be all about it. But I don't think that was primarily the dance. I think it was primarily like DJ danced. For people who like those experiences, it's great. I haven't really done many of them because, again, it's a kind of high price point for it. It has to be more than an Instagram dive for me.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, no, there's so many. We've talked about this because when I talked about the Balloon Museum, I talked about how there are a lot of those Instagram museum experiences or whatever, where it all does seem to just be engineered for social media, where the value you get out of it isn't actually going to the thing or experiencing the thing. It's capturing your experience of the thing. And at that point, I'm just like, y'all, I know I'm old. I know it. You don't have to tell me. I realize I'm old. My body reminds me on a daily basis, but I just don't go in for that kind of stuff.
There are experiences that also are highly Instagrammable, but the experience itself is something that even if you don't get a single picture, you're going to remember it.
Yeah.
Meow Wolf to me.
Yes.
Is one of those. And you know, I'm in a photography scavenger hunt that I do, like every 3 months, there's a new one. And I pay $5 for it. So, I can make my own Instagrammable pictures. The problem with something like that is if I go to like, I know a lot of people who've had fun at the Balloon Museum, and that's fantastic. I bet if I went, I'd have fun. I'm just a cheapskate. but, you know, if I take my picture in front of the same wall with 50 balloons that somebody else does, unless I have a story to go with it, it's paying for a picture with Santa Claus.
The Balloon Museum I justified only because I knew that consisted of exhibits that actual artists had put together with artistic intent. And it wasn't just something thrown together to, again, appeal to social media. Although it definitely falls, it's closer to that category than, say, going to the High Museum of Art, certainly, by a mile. But I was like, I'm willing to give this a shot because of what it is. And I thought it was fine. And I enjoyed the experience for what it was. And I did take a couple of pictures, but I don't have social media accounts where I post pictures anymore, really. So for me, like, it has to be an experience that I'm going to enjoy all on its own without the social media component, because I don't do that anymore. So.
Well, and like an art exhibit would be that. I go around and I look at Christmas lights every year because I enjoy the experience. I'd probably enjoy a lantern festival or, you know, going through Nights of Lights or whatever. So I totally get that. And that's totally valid. And I forgot that the balloon exhibit was also an art exhibit. That makes it much better.
It definitely does still fall into what you were saying, though. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. No. I was just going to bring us back to Bridgerton season three.
Yes, because other stuff.
Yeah, so this season three, each season kind of follows the pairing up of a different sibling of the Bridgerton family or child of the Bridgerton family. And this season deals with Colin and his longtime childhood friend Penelope, who comes from a less affluent but much more trying to be affluent family. And Colin has snubbed Penelope through the previous two seasons. And this is kind of where Penelope gets her glow up, as to say, like, she dresses better and learns to have more confidence. It's kind of an ugly duckling story, but all along she's been a power player. It's just been more undercover. And then Colin kind of learning to be a cool dude instead of kind of a butt dude.
Yeah.
The costuming is a lot of fun.
A butt, dude.
What? A butt. He was being a butt.
Okay. Okay. I think being a butt is different from being a butt, dude. But who am I to judge.
Okay. From being a jerk face. Is that better?
Okay. Got it. Now you're speaking my language.
Okay. And sort of their romance. I do think it's a little funny. It was recently in the news that Nicola Coughlan, who plays Penelope Featherington, she was also in Dairy Girls, if you recognize the name, agreed to do this season if she could get a PG cut to share with her parents.
That's funny.
I think it's delightful. If you like romance and you like A Knight's Tale, you'll probably like Bridgerton. I'm not normally a romance girly, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's an easy watch.
I was worried while watching the trailer that it was going to turn into one of those, let's let her hair down and take off her glasses. Now suddenly the girl is like stunning, but it's not handled so heavy-handed as that in the trailer, at least. So that is somewhat reassuring.
Yeah. I mean, she's very smart through the entire series. And I think Nicola Coughlin's gorgeous.
She is.
You know, it's more that learning that confidence, mm-hmm. and self-assuredness. I was going to say something else, but now I don't remember.
I'm very good at hijacking the conversation.
No, that's good. No, I'm looking forward to it. Oh, I really did like Queen Charlotte, though. I think I talked about that when I watched it, which was an offshoot, because in the Bridgerton series, Queen Charlotte is the reigning monarch. She was married to King George, who went mad. The Madness of King George is a really great old movie. I don't know if it holds up, but it's a great old movie.
It's not that old, but
he
yes.
did have mental illness. What?
I said it's not that old, but...
What'd you say?
I said it's not that old, but that's because I remember when that movie came out in theaters.
It was in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that old.
Back when Helen Mirren was considered young.
She's still hot, though, by the way.
I'm not going to... She is. Look, I don't think age and attractiveness go hand in hand. I love The Madness of King George III. I thought it was a good movie. It could probably use a slight update, but regardless, I thought that the Queen Charlotte series, while still a romance series, dealt very well with a spouse dealing with another spouse who is struggling with mental illness. And it was in that time period. And so I found it very moving, actually.
Mm.
I cried. Well,
here's hoping that for Bridgerton fans that they get a season that stands up to the other ones they already enjoyed. The trailer, like, I don't have a point of reference, so I'll say that the trailer looked like it was very well produced, but it didn't speak to me, mm-hmm. simply because that's not my world. So that's not a judgment on the series itself. It's just that I have no point of contact with that show.
Yeah. And then we were going to talk about a whole bunch of things that were hitting the news. Nosferatu, Wicked, Borderlands, Deadpool, and Wolverine. But really the only news is that news outlets are saying, hey, we got to go to CinemaCon and you didn't. So we saw cool stuff and you don't get to see it yet.
Yeah. Like all of this stuff was stuff where people were expressly told not to take their phones out and shoot footage of it. In fact, Hugh Jackman as Wolverine apparently had a profanity-laced filmed statement about how that was not allowed. It sounded like it was hilarious, but we didn't get to see that either because no one was allowed to shoot. So we just got descriptions of everything after the fact.
Yeah, which is frustrating when I'm seeing a bunch of articles going, first looks at Nosferatu, and then there's nothing.
Yeah.
There are, like, if you go on the IMDb page, there's a couple of things, but it's not what they were alluding to.
Right. It's like, it's theater of the mind. They're just describing it and you have to imagine it. There were a couple of things like images released and stuff that we did get to see. Like, I think it was Bill Skarsgård who's playing the vampire, Orlok, not in, yes. Nosferatu. Like there was a picture of him as Orlok, but, we didn't get to see the 9 minutes of footage they showed of Deadpool and Wolverine, for example. But yeah, it sounds like there was a lot of impressive stuff. I would have liked to have seen more like reactions from various folks who did go just to kind of get a feel for what worked and what didn't. But you know, I'm sure it was cool to have been there.
Yeah, the reactions I saw for Nosferatu were that it was very good and it's going to be very genuinely scary. So
that's good.
I don't know if I'll be able to handle it.
Sure you will. You can just sit there and go like, this is just like Bram Stoker's Dracula.
That wasn't scary.
That's what I'm saying. If you could just say that over and over again, you'll be fine.
With my eyes closed and my ears plugged, so it will actually, I'll actually be watching Bram Stoker's Dracula just in the theater for Nosferatu.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past someone in some of the theaters I've been in, so.
Yeah, that is true. Although I will say the last movie I went to go see, Ghostbusters, ended up having a really like respectful audience in it. It was delightful.
Nice.
Yeah, it was super great. Nobody was on their phone. The only time people were talking were like laughing a little bit. It was a wonderful experience. It wasn't a super full theater, unfortunately, but everybody there was super cool.
Speaking of super cool, emphasis on the super.
Did you like Heroes? Do you like Heroes?
So you're talking about the television series Heroes. I liked the first season of Heroes, but it was one of those shows where the longer the season went on, the more it was clear that the show creators had an idea for where they wanted to go, but they had not really plotted it out because there was a lot of like stalling, it felt like, to get to, mm-hmm. you know, because they did a lot of establishing first up, because the whole concept of Heroes is that normal people start to manifest superpowers, and not everyone gets them, but the people who do get them, they don't know what connects them or why they've suddenly got superpowers. And some of them decide to embrace their superpowers and become heroes. Some of them become villains. Some of them try to ignore the fact that they have powers entirely. And it was a really interesting concept. This was before we got to the explosion of superhero content that would follow in further years, right? Like we did not have the Marvel Cinematic Universe when Heroes came out. And the reason we brought it up is because the creator of that series, Tim Kring, is planning on doing a new series, not a reboot either, or not exactly. It's supposed to be new characters in that same world, from what I gather. So that's interesting.
Yeah, although they said some of the villains might be the same, and I think that that might be a mistake, because I think the biggest problem, because I watched one of the later seasons of Heroes, they ended up going to a carnival, and really Claire, the cheerleader, was one of the only overarching characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it was a mistake to have old characters come through to the new story. I also watched the spinoff that they had later, that had like a video game girl in it, but it had Hero from the original Heroes in it. And that was okay. But again, when you're trying to put your old convoluted story into a new story and make it make sense, it just gets messy. So I hope they come up with new villains for it. But I did enjoy the original series.
It's also weird because now, of course, we do live in a world where we have a glut of superhero content, both from Marvel and DC, and then other stuff that's not necessarily directly connected to Marvel or DC, but still kind of falls in that superhero genre. And I'm very curious if there will be as much of an appetite for a new Heroes series when, at least for some people, there's still this perception of there's nothing to go see in the theater except superhero movies, because that seems to be like the most popular genre in theaters, you know, year after year. It's a little less so this year than it has been in years past. Like Marvel has chilled the heck out, at least for as far as film releases. I think Deadpool and Wolverine is like the only one we're getting this year, I think. Whereas in most years,
yeah, but they're advertising Fantastic Four.
Sure, but we're not getting it this year, right? Like there are some years where we were getting three or four MCU movies. So
yeah, I personally feel like there's a difference with Heroes, though, because it's not in a world that is set up to have superheroes.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's interesting because I would say the first Iron Man felt that way to me, right? Like there was no indication in Iron Man that all these other heroes had already existed. Like you didn't know about Captain Marvel or Captain America even in that first Iron Man movie. There was no reference to them. So like, as far as you could tell, Iron Man was like, and of course he doesn't actually have superpowers. He builds a suit that gives him those powers, but you know, Iron Man was like an anomaly. And it was only later that you started to find out, oh no, actually this universe has a rich history of superpowered individuals. Let me introduce you to the Eternals. And then you can walk away because that is boring as heck. But
wasn't there like an Easter egg in the Norton version of the Hulk?
Yeah. Yeah, at the very end of the Hulk. Because that movie is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The Hulk is the second film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The first one is Iron Man, and the second one is the Hulk.
Did Hulk come out after Iron Man?
It did.
I thought it came out first.
No, it came out after because Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark shows up at the very end and talks to Thunderbolt Ross. Yeah, that's like Iron Man's first. And I know this because I own the phase 1 through 4 DVD sets and they are organized chronologically by release date, not by when the film takes place, but by release date.
Gotcha.
So Iron Man came out
first.
I did too. Like when I sat there and thought back and I was like, oh, the Hulk came out and then they decided they were going to do this big interconnected universe. Nope. The Hulk was movie 2. In the series, just it was a movie that hardly anyone went to go see, which is why it was such a big deal when they recast the character with Mark Ruffalo coming in. That was a big thing. And Robert Downey Jr. at that Comic Con came out and hyped up the crowd to introduce Mark Ruffalo, knowing that there was already this like hurdle to get over because he wasn't the guy who played the Hulk in the film. So.
Interesting things that, you know, every geek has their blind spots. That was one of mine.
I mean, I only know it because I looked it up well after the fact, because I was the same as you. I thought the Hulk came out before Iron Man, and then it was only like retrofitted to be kind of sort of in part of the timeline.
Yeah. I didn't hate it. I didn't hate the Ed Norton Hulk. Well, and I know that we've gotten Tim Roth in like She-Hulk as the Abomination.
Yeah. And there's, I think there's talk of some of the other characters from that Hulk film potentially showing up in other Marvel movies down the line, but we'll have to see. And I don't think I ever even finished the movie. I started watching it because I own it in that DVD set. And I think I got 2/3 of the way through and then something came up and I turned it off and I never bothered turning it back on, which tells you how much it grabbed me.
I do that with a lot of movies. I do that with more TV shows and I hate it because I'll like the TV show and then I'll get distracted because there is so much media out there. As an actor, I love it. But as a viewer, it's sometimes hard. And then that TV show gets canceled because enough people didn't watch the first season to the end. And I'm a part of the problem.
Well, for me, it happens with shows that just stay on the air. And then I get further and further behind to a point where I am intimidated to jump back in. Like Bob's Burgers is a great example. I love that show. Mm-hmm. But I paused watching it like 5 or 6 years ago, and now there's all those episodes and I'm like, I really need to get back to it, and the longer I wait the more there's going to be to watch. But there's so much already.
Yeah, see, I've taken a break, but I'm watching through Community and King of the Hill, and I'm starting after they finished, but there's a lot to get through, so yeah. I understand.
Well, we still have something to get through too, even though our show's running a bit long, and that is we promise y'all a mashup, and we've got it. And the two properties we decided to mash up were Dune and Spice World, the Spice Girls movie.
Yeah, this was Jonathan's idea. We know, I know that some of you are as big of a fan as the mashups. A lot of you guys have said we want mashups, so this is your fault. This was Jonathan's idea, but we do have your suggestions that have come through on Discord and email to work to go through as we continue to do mashups. It's just for the first one, we wanted to lob like an easy, like a softball. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to shake the ring rust off because we haven't done this in a long time.
Goodness.
So Ariel, do you want to go first or shall I?
I can go first because it's shorter. Everybody should know what Dune is because we've talked about it a bunch on this show. If you aren't familiar with Spice World, it is a movie that the Spice Girls made. The Spice Girls, well, I'll explain it in my mashup. So we didn't actually compare titles. So if I've taken your title, Jonathan, I'm very sorry. This is called Spice Up Your Spice.
I love it.
So spice up your life. Okay. So the girls were at it again. You know, the Spice Girls, that sexy Britpop band from the late 90s, early 2000s. And by again, I mean they were gearing up to do a reunion tour to once more take London and the world by storm. They loaded into their double-decker bus and headed on their adventure. But for those who are familiar, adventure for the Spice Girls was rarely without danger, and it was no different this time. Sort of. As soon as they started on their tour prep, the earthquakes started. Never massive, but enough to take note of. Earthquakes are not unheard of in London, but they weren't super common either. And that's when the girls noticed it. A shadowy figure with glowing blue eyes watching them. The girls upped their security and locked the doors, but everywhere they went, the same thing happened. Earthquake, shadowy figure with glowing blue eyes. Yet the figure never did more than be a creeper. Then one day, while the Spice Girls were at their final sound check for their tour, they had enough. Scary Spice, being the bravest, marched right up to the figure and demanded an explanation for its stalkery behavior. The figure apologized and introduced themselves as Leto to Atreides. He said that the spice on their planet was becoming scarce, largely due to the disappearance of sandworms, and he had gotten a signal that there were spice worms on a distant planet called Earth. So he had his navigator send him to Earth pronto. Unfortunately, Leto was dismayed to find out that the signal was misinterpreted, and that spice worms were actually spice women. But he had also noticed the earthquakes, and so followed the women to see if there was any truth at all to the original assumption. And sadly, up to this point, his efforts were turning up nothing. Scary was admittedly confused, but relayed the info to the other girls. And being such chill and cool folk, while they couldn't help Leto, they did invite him to their concert that night. And that is when things took a turn for the weird. I have a typo here where my computer instead put things took Saturn for the weird. Either way, at the concert that night, as soon as they began to play, a massive earthquake hit, rending the floor of the concert hall. Something or some things was coming right for the girls. They called for the hall to be evacuated, and that's when they saw them. The five most massive sandworms to ever exist. Accidentally transported to the center of the Earth and called forth by the massive good vibrations of the Spice Girls' music. Leto, too, tried to save them, but it was too late. The sandworms devoured the Spice Girls, and all seemed to be lost. But in a magic Sailor Moon-esque turn of events, the girls and the sandworms were merged together into some sort of symbiote. Leto knew this was a fate foretold for him, but now that he saw it, he was real glad it happened to someone else. The Spice Worm girls, however, never to be stopped, took their new forms in stride. Their new, more wormy bodies provided a soul-vibrating addition to their music that had never been heard or felt on Earth before, calling to the hearts of all music connoisseurs. The band continued their tour, launched their own line of spice-based products and merch to sell to both Earth and Arrakis and the rest of space, saving multiple planets, bringing a new vibe to the music industry, and securing trade throughout the galaxies. The end.
Wow. Okay, well, you, as always, before we started recording, Ariel expressed the concern that perhaps, despite the fact that we do not collaborate at all when we're working on our mashups, that we might have created the same story. You can rest assured we did not. That was great.
Okay.
That was great.
Thank you.
Mine, I'm going to call it Spice World, sealed with Arrakis. Instead of Arrakis, but it is Arrakis. Here we go.
I love it.
Spicy Paul has a problem. Well, he's got a lot of problems. For one thing, his spice daddy got all murderized. And by spice daddy, I mean his actual father, not some sort of special friend. Spice daddy's demise means that Spicy Paul has inherited the spice world, and managing baby, posh, ginger, sporty, and scary has been quite the task. Not only are the five Spice Girls all independent women getting it done, they've all become a little frustrated by the fact that the Fremen on Spice World aren't so into their brand of bubblegum pop, which means their concerts typically end up being for a couple of rocks and the odd sandworm. What's worse is that McMaxford Harkonnen seems determined to end their careers once and for all. And boy howdy, has Harkonnen tried. For one thing, he's the guy responsible for the murderization of Spicy Paul's Spice Daddy. I know, he's a terrible person. But our Spice Five aren't ready to lay it all down just yet. They have a big plan to win the Fremen over with a free outdoor concert in the Sand Bowl, which is the name for the outdoor amphitheater on Arrakis. It's down to Spicy Paul to get all the details just right, and he sure does have his work cut out for him. It's hard to convince his five charges to wear their still suits, for example. Ugh, no, I won't put that thing up my nose, Ginger would say. You'll die without it, argues Spicy Paul. If I wore it, I would immediately die from shame, Posh Spice replied. And ultimately, Paul had to settle on the girls making significant changes to the suit's design, almost all of which negated the purpose for wearing it in the first place. In fact, most of his days were spent scrambling up what little water there was just to keep the girls alive. Now we pause the film so that we get the Spice Girls singing Saturday Night Sandworms. Okay, meanwhile, McMaxford Harkonnen gets wind of the concert plans, and he says, "We must destroy Spicy Paul and his Spice Girls." And he bellows this to no one in particular. And soon, he develops a plan. He will send a CD photographer named Richard O'Brien, who also was Riff Raff in Rocky Horror Picture Show. And Richard O'Brien's got to go and sneak up on the girls and take pictures and videos of them during unflattering moments, all in an effort to like discredit them in the eyes of fans. Also, he would send Peter DeVries, who is an evil Mentos, and upon contact with Diet Coke, he explodes. And it would be Peter DeVries' job to take out Spicy Paul. So then we have to pause the movie again, because now the Spice Girls have to sing, "I'm the leader of the Fremen," open bracket, "I am," closed bracket. Then we cut back to Spicy Paul, who's running into issues with the plan for getting the group to the Sand Bowl on time. Because the girls keep asking for time off so they can spend it with their Bene Gesserit friend, Nicola, who is expecting and is due any day now. But Spicy Paul keeps denying them. He's worried about distractions leading up to the Sand Bowl, as well as the fact that McMaxford Harkonnen is intent on destroying them all. But the girls do slip away, and they find themselves out in front of a crashed ornithopter in the middle of the desert.
"Yeah, do you remember when we did a gig at this very crash site when we were just starting out?" says Scary Spice.
I do, says Baby Spice. And then Sporty Spice says something that's not very funny and just reminds everyone of that time that she was on Big Fat Quiz Show of the Year and no one liked her. Anyway, the girls run into Nikki, and they decide it's time to go dancing. Just as they get into a groove with a cool song called Fear is the Mind Killer, Nicola goes into labor, and there's this hilarious sequence where they try to get her to a hospital before they realize there aren't any hospitals on Spice World that aren't under direct Harkonnen control. So Nicola gives birth in the desert to a little girl, and that plot gets to go away now. But then we pause the film so that the Spice Girls can sing If You Wanna Be My Kwisatz Haderach. And then the girls suddenly realize that they're running late for that concert, so Spicy Paul is sure gonna be miffed, and we do a smash cut to Spicy Paul, who's murdering the heck out of Peter DeVries by pouring a 2-liter of Diet Coke down his throat, which causes him to blow up, as I mentioned earlier. Smash cut back to the girls, who run into Richard O'Brien, but then they convince him to stop being a creep and instead maybe go to do another sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, like Shock Treatment. And O'Brien sighs and says, "Fine." And on his way out, he ends up blackmailing McMaxford Harkonnen with photos of him romping around with some floozies in his big, oily, nasty ooze pit that he likes to bathe in. So that plot can go away now, too. And we pause the movie again so that the Spice Girls can sing, "The Lady is a Reverend Mother and also a Vamp." Then the girls' song attracts the attention of a sandworm, which they quickly wrangle, and then they ride the sandworm in a frenzied attempt to get to the Sand Bowl on time for the concert. And at one point, apropos of nothing, with no setup whatsoever, Baby Spice discovers there's a bomb on the worm. Why? Who knows? Probably won't come back anyway. So the worm gets to the venue just in time, though some Fremen highway patrol are really miffed about the traffic violations, but formerly fortunately rather, with some eyelash batting from Baby Spice, the girls are able to get through. And they get to the Sandy Bowl, which is just packed with Fremen, because Spicy Paul has done a great job promoting the event, and they have a fantastic show. But unfortunately, it attracts like 12 more sandworms, and everyone gets eaten. Also, at the very end, the bomb sandworm explodes, and it's really gross. The end. But, over the credits, we get the song, the final song, which is called Dune, Spice Up Your Life. It goes a little something like la 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 la. When you need to fly through space, we'll throw spice right in your face. You will feel that you will change when you dose with our melange. Fremen, raise your fists, spice up your life. Mentats with a twist, spice up your life. Harkonnens in your midst, spice up your life. Ah. Ornithopters to the left if you're having a good time. Sandworms to your right if you know that you feel fine. Bene Gesserit to the front. Ha ha. Go round. And then like all the girls in the audience will start singing this while the credits are going, and it will get in your head and it will give you a migraine, and your really good friends will insist on singing it at karaoke. And it's clear they're having a fun time, and that's good. Like, that should happen. You should be supportive of the fact that your friends are just enjoying themselves. Even though it is killing you to sit through that experience, the end.
I love it. I'm surprised you didn't full out sing, but that's okay.
It's partly because I forgot how the tune goes. Like, it's one of those things where, like, I thought before we started recording, like, I should probably listen to the song just to remember how it all, but like, honestly, that bit about the karaoke thing is real, in that sometimes at karaoke, sometimes that song gets picked and the women in the group love to sing it, which is fantastic. I do not wish to yuck their yum or deny their joy. And by sing, I really am being kind, because it's more like screaming it. And by the end of it, I'm just like, I need a quiet place for a little while.
Full disclosure, while I liked the Spice Girls, I didn't enjoy their music till kind of after they stopped being in prominence. You said nobody liked Melanie C, Sporty Spice. I didn't watch her on that Big Fat Quiz Show. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. It's actually technically, I think it was Scary Spice who was on the Big Fat Quiz Show. That was me making a mistake in my script.
Okay, because I would say I don't know much about any of the Spice Girls, other than that Victoria Beckham is Posh Spice is married to a soccer player.
Yeah.
But Melanie C did play an amazing Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar. Just blew it out of the water.
Yes. Yeah, so the it was Mel B who was in Big Fat Quiz Show. So I should have said Scary Spice, not Sporty Spice. That was on me. That is sloppy writing on my part. But in my defense, it's two people with the almost identical names. what's also funny is that I didn't know this either, because full disclosure, I've never seen Spice World all the way through. I've seen bits of it, but I didn't remember until I actually watched the preview for the film that by this point they weren't going by Baby, Posh, and Ginger. They were going by their names. So that was something that I had already written that part, and it's like, nah, they're going to keep it with Baby, Posh, Ginger, Scary, and Sporty.
I don't remember that at all. I think I do remember Baby Spice being like, oh, this is kind of weird that I got to be a baby. I might also be making that up in my head.
In the trailer, at least, the voiceover references them by like Emma and, you know, Mel B and Mel C and et cetera. So.
Gotcha. Well, that is it for our show. We got to wrap things up.
Don't ask me how they get into contact, because if we're doing mashups, I'm not also doing a long explanation of how they can get in touch with us.
Cool. So maybe we'll alternate. So if you do want to get in touch with us, you can reach out on social media, on Facebook, Threads, Discord, and Instagram. We're Large Nerdron Collider. On Twitter/X, we are LNC_podcast. You can also email us at largenerdronpod@gmail.com. All of our show notes will be up on our website, www.largeneutroncollider.com. Last week's episode is up. This week's episode will be up soon. We love hearing from you. So, you know, share your thoughts, share your fun, share your own mashups. Tell your friends. And I'm done rambling as Jonathan shakes his water bottle at me. So until next time, I am Ariel Ginger, but not the spice, Kasten.
And I'm Jonathan. You gotta get with my friends, Strickland. The Large Neutron Collider was created by Ariel Kasten and produced, edited, published, deleted, undeleted, published again, cursed at, by Jonathan Strickland. Music by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com.